Welcome again to Word Balloon. This is John Suntress. 91-year-old Bud Schulberg has led an incredible life and career. He's best known for his 1941 novel, What Makes Sammy Run, and his 1954 Academy Award-winning screenplay for On the Waterfront. He encountered political controversy in 1947 because of his appearance before the House Un-American Activities Committee, in which he appeared as a friendly witness. For those looking for explanations as to why Bud testified, he addressed his reasons in print and on video many times, most recently in the DVD supplemental documentary for A Face in the Crowd. Boxing is my connection to Bud. I met him through our mutual friend and former Boxing Illustrated publisher, Bert Sugar. We've had great times in New York and Las Vegas comparing the fighters Bud has seen live since the 1930s. While working on an audio documentary for the 75th anniversary of the 1927 Jack Dempsey-Gene Tunney fight, I arranged a phone interview with Bud to get his recollections of the classic bout. At 88 years old, Schulberg was kind enough to indulge my curiosity about two of my favorite films, The Harder They Fall and A Face in the Crowd. He was preparing to leave the next day to cover the Lennox Lewis-Mike Tyson heavyweight title fight.
What draws people like us to boxing, Bud? You've written about it. You've written about it in fiction. You've written about it in fact. What is it about boxing that really appeals to us?
Well, I think it's for the dramatist. For me, without any question, a major turning point fight is the most dramatic event of sports. In tennis, if you lose the Australian Open, you're playing next at the U.S. Open. And even if you lose the World Series, chances are you very often will get a chance. Wait until next year. But in boxing, there are times when that is really it and defines the rest of their lives. When Mike Tyson, if he loses, should get knocked out, say, I think it could be the end of the Tyson drama. There's always that one do-or-die time in boxing. I've seen it over and over again, in which one fighter goes on and the other one really is never the same again. It's just such a dramatic moment. Also, it's such an intense one-on-one sport. It's so naked, really, literally and figuratively naked sport. I always feel some sense of terror when I go to a big fight, like the one I'm on my way to tomorrow, in fact. I feel almost trembling inside. I fear for the fighters. And while I'm a big sports fan and follow, I guess, almost every sport, none of them have that effect on me, dramatic effect that boxing has.
Is it that fear of what might happen that drew you specifically to the Carnera story in writing The Harder They Fall?
Not as much, frankly, John, because in the Carnera story, as I watched it develop with fascination, you knew what was going to happen. You knew that Carnera was going to win. You sensed, if you didn't know, and after a while I knew that Carnera was a mob-controlled fighter, really almost a puppet in their hands, and that they were pulling all the strings. You knew that, and it fascinated me. As it happened, we were going to Europe in 1929, and Young Stribling was a contender, pretty good boxer, heavyweight, mm-hmm. fought for the title, Paul Charkey, and so forth. Young Stribling and his family were on their way to London to fight this giant that they talked about called Carnera. And so my father and I went to see that fight in London. I was about 14 to 15, I guess. And we knew quite a bit about fights, and we smelled that something was not right in that fight. In the first one, Stribling won in on a foul in the sixth round. And then they moved on to Paris a month or so later. And we saw the second one in Paris, in which it was the same thing in reverse with a foul in the sixth round. Carnera won. My father and I knew from then on, really, that in a way the fix was in for Carnera. It didn't really happen until Carnera came to this country and then was totally controlled by the mob in New York.
When you wrote the book in 1947, The Harder They Fall, mm-hmm. did you receive any type of flack or any type of real threats from the mob?
Yeah, when the center of the sporting world took Shores, which opened shortly after that, yeah, I used to have trouble in there in Shores by people cussing me out and kind of threatening me in a way. And one claim to fame I have is that Barney Ross, the great welterweight champion, he was so infuriated at me when someone told Barney I had written that book. He actually wanted to take me outside. He actually wanted to go ahead and beat me up. People were upset is hardly the word they were. In my own case, it got more serious than the book is when I was covering the Basilio-Saxon fight. I think that was 52 or 53, somewhere in there. that fight was clearly fixed before Saxton. Mm-hmm. And I read a very, very strong piece titled Boxing's Dirty Business Must Be Cleaned Up Now. And I nailed the fight as a total sellout, and that the Cobbler Bunch were completely controlling at that time the welterweights and the middleweights. And next time I went to the Garden, they wouldn't let me in. I was amazed that they even knew who I was, because fighters aren't very well known by their faces. But I was barred from the Garden for some time after that. At that time, I did get threats, phone call threats and stuff like that.
Were you scared? You
took I was a little nervous, yeah, but I didn't know what to do about it, so I just kept on going.
Did the Kefauver Commission, did you ever have to speak on behalf of them when they did finally investigate the mob influence in boxing?
No, they didn't call me. They did not call me.
Interesting.
The FBI came to see me, oddly, and asked me what more I knew about mob operations in boxing. But the Kefauver did not call me.
Okay. 10 years after the book was made, Columbia made the film.
Yes.
And we've talked about it before a couple times at fights, and I've asked you about it. You did not write the script.
Well, no, it's not quite that, John. More specifically, I liked and actually had worked on the script, and I liked about 85% of the script. I thought they did it very well. But after I got off the picture, I got into a fight with Harry Cohen, a man who ran Columbia Pictures that was making the movie,
mm-hmm.
and I got into a thing with him. And so I was off the picture. After that, they added two things without my approval, to say the least, that really shook me. In the film, as in real life, Conera had ostensibly killed a pretty good heavyweight fighter, Ernie Schaaf.
Yes.
And as it turned out, Ernie Schaaf, because Conera, in spite of his monstrous size, was oddly enough not much of a puncher. What really had happened is that Max Baer and beaten Schaaf very badly, and that Schaaf was probably on his way to dying from serious brain damage when he met Conera. In the film, they added a scene that was not in my book or in my script, in which Max Baer says that he deserves the credit for that death, not Tomo Molina, who was my character in the movie. I resented that because I've seen fighters damage other fighters over the years. I had one very good friend of mine, in which he, in a sense, killed an opponent, and never recovered from it. And my experience was that fighters have a dread, Ezzard Charles, the same thing with Ezzard, killed a fighter in Chicago.
Yes.
They have a dread that this might happen. It's the last thing in the world they want to happen, and many, many times they never recover from it. So I resented the fact that they showed a fighter saying that I deserve credit for that death. And second thing is that at the end of the film, they added what I thought was a fortuitous moment in which Humphrey Bogart rolls a piece of blank paper in the typewriter, and he types out the title, The Harder They Fall, and then he types out that boxing must be abolished. Now, I caught hell for that because, again, the boxing people naturally assumed that was me writing that.
Sure.
And they were saying, how the hell can you keep going to fight? I want to abolish them. And I said, Jesus, I don't want to abolish them. I'd like to see them reformed. I'd like to see boxing. The management of it desperately needs to be reformed, yes, but I'm not about to try to abolish boxing. So I wrote a piece for Sports Illustrated. You could look it up, in which I took the movie to task on those two points. But it was not the whole script, John. It was what they did with it, I felt, after I left it. They tacked a sort of a Hollywood ending on it.
Did you know at the time how sick Bogey was when he was making the film?
I did, yes, because I talked to him quite a bit. He came east with the director, and they wanted to go to Stillman's and walk around the fight scene. And I knew he was pretty ill, yes, but I didn't realize that he was actually working on his very last film and that the days were short. But I knew he was ill, yes.
So, and again, from your standpoint, about 85% to 90%, you're satisfied with the film?
Yeah, I thought they did a good job on it. I thought they followed the book quite well. They also took a lot of my script. I thought Mark Robeson, the director, did a very good job on it. I thought the acting stood up well. Bogey was always good. Stagger was always stagger and effective, yes. The big wrestler who played Toro, Mike Lane, I thought he did an amazingly sensitive job on it. I was very impressed with him.
And also it was wonderful to see all the fighters, Pat, not only Max Baer, but Pat Comiskey.
Yeah, that's right. He was, and Jersey Joe Walcott had lines in it, too.
A very significant supporting part is George, yeah.
Yes, he did. I've always found that in the work I've done in films, I've always tried to get fighters in as much as I can. Maybe because they are performers, and it's interesting that so often when they're interviewed, as you know, they will discuss it as my performance. Floyd Patterson always graded his performance. So in a sense, they are performers, and they're used to being seen in public and in a way acting out, which is the basis for the being effective actors, as we found with The Waterfront and in film I did called Wind Across the Everglades. I had Tony Galindo in it in a fairly good part also.
Okay, let's finish up then with my favorite movie in just a couple minutes on A Face in the Crowd, I absolutely love that movie, Bud, and I really think that Andy Griffith's performance shows what kind of range he has as an actor, and everyone can laugh at Sheriff Andy, and by all means deserves all the credit for The Andy Griffith Show in Matlock, his gospel singing career, his Broadway performance in No Time for Sergeants.
Right.
But to show such range and such darkness in Face of the Crowd was just incredible.
Yes, it was. It really was. I don't know if it's Tales out of School or not, but Kazan said to me, he said, but we have to work on Andy day and night. I mean, he's got that side. I know he has that side in him. I felt it in talking to him. But we have to keep hitting on him, reaching and reaching and reaching in and pulling that out. And he said, I'll work on him all day, and you go out drinking with him all night. And we just work on the serious impact of this, what it can be. And he certainly came through. He came through, but he never really wanted to do anything like that again, frankly.
Really? That's a shame, because I think he really missed an opportunity to show real range and real balance as an actor.
And tremendous power. He really showed it in that, don't doubt it. The amazing thing about that is that film got not a single nomination. It got no attention, very little at all. I would have thought that Andy, such a breakthrough performance as that, had to be nominated, but completely overlooked.
And the story is really one of the forgotten Kazan-Schulberg collaborations, I think. And sometimes people really do have to be reminded, because as I'm going to ask you, the story resonates today and could very easily be made today. The theme of the story still is powerful. The corruption and how easily these tin-plated gods are created by television and by the mass media. And the power they wield.
That's true. It is true. It's true more than ever, I think. Really, I do. And is a real danger in our country that kind of power, sometimes for the wrong reasons, can be wielded. They're talking about, right now, they're talking about remaking it over at Warner Brothers.
You had told me a couple of years ago that Jim Carrey was possibly looking at it, and I had heard that he wanted to look at it, but also wanted to be able to kind of manipulate the script. And I found that kind of interesting, given the body of your work, that, you know, Ace Ventura, the clown, really had the kind of nerve. I took exception to that and said, wait a minute. I think you wrote a hell of a script, bud, and I really don't think there's any need to change much in terms of modernizing it.
I know. I hear now, got a call the other day that Will Smith is now interested in doing it.
Wow.
And I'm hearing the same rumors about fiddling with that and fiddling with the ending and so forth. I'm asking him to send me the script.
Do you have enough power to be able to refuse and say, no, not that way, and you'll do it my way or no way?
Sadly, John, I wish I did. They can remake it. I don't think I have. Only power I have is a kind of moral persuasion. Try.
Good luck.
It's
Hollywood. Good luck.
Yeah, but I really don't think, where those contracts read, or at least that as that one read, I'm afraid that they control it.
So the word balloon suggestion is, before Hollywood does remake this and tack on a lousy Hollywood ending, do yourself a favor. Go out and get A Face in the Crowd, starring Andy Griffith, an amazing film written by Bud Schulberg. Thanks a lot for listening to this edition of WordBalloon.com. This is John Suntress. Make sure you tune in next time for more interviews right here. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2005.